Good morning, everyone. I'm sitting here with Mark and Mike Orr and my wife, Rosette. Well, my wife, Rosette's on her way in here, but anyway. We're getting ready to continue. Mark has been reading through Arthur Pink's The Doctrine of Election. He's ready for Chapter 10, Part 2. And like I say every morning, if you want a copy of this book, you can go to greatchristianbooks.com and get you a copy. So I'll turn this over to Mark and have him read for us.
Doctrine of Election, Chapter 10, Part 2. We shall now attempt to cover the whole range of objections which we have brought against the doctrine of election. Yet our discussion would be incomplete if we totally ignored them. The workings of unbelief are always endless in number. The child of God needs to be occupied with something more profitable. Yet we feel that we should at least consider briefly the ones which the enemy supposed the most forceful and formidable. Not that our object is to try and convince them of their errors, but rather with the design of seeking to help fellow hyphen believers who may have been shaken, if not stumbled thereby. The business is not to repute error, but under God to establish our readers in the truth. Yet, in order to do this, it is sometimes needful to expose the wiles of Satan, show how baseless are the most insidious of his lies, and seek to remove from a Christian's mind injurious effect they may have had upon him. Before starting on this unwelcome task, let it be pointed out that any lack of ability on our part to refute the calamities of opponents is no proof that their position is impregnable. As a renowned butler pointed out long ago in his masterly analogy, if a truth is established, objections are nothing. The one, i.e. truth, is founded upon our knowledge and the other on our ignorance. Once it is established that two and two make four, no quibbling or juggling with figures can prove it. We should never suffer what we know to be disturbed by what we know not, said the master of logic, Paley. Once we see anything to be fairly taught and wholly writ, we must not allow either our own prejudices or the antagonism of others to shake our confidence or our adherence to it. We are satisfied that we have it, thus saith the Lord, to rest upon. It matters nothing if we be unable to show the sophistry and the arguments brought to bear against it. Be assured that God is true, even if that involves or accounting every man a liar. The bitterest enemies against the doctrine of election are the Papists. This is exactly what might be expected. The truth of election can nearly be made to square with the dogma of human merits. The one is diametrically opposed to the other. Every man who loves himself and seeks salvation by his own works will loathe sovereign grace and seek to load it with contempt. On the other hand, those who have been effectually humbled by the Holy Spirit and brought to realize that they are utterly dependent upon this amazing mercy of God will have no hankerings after nor patience with the system which sets the crown of honor upon the creature. History bears ample testimony that Rome detests the very name of Calvinism. From all sects there may be some hope of obtaining converts to Rome against Calvinism, but the late Cardinal Manning, and he was right, as our own degenerate age bears full witness. For while no regenerated Calvinist will ever be fatally deceived by the wiles of mud, harlots, or a thousand Protestant Arminians are annually rushing to her arms. It is an irrefutable fact that as Calvinism has met with less and less favor in the leading Protestant bodies, the sovereignty of God and his electing love have been more and more crowded out of their pulpits, that Rome has been increasing progress until today she must have both England and USA a greater number of followers than any single evangelical denomination. But what is saddest of all is that the vast majority of those now occupying so-called Protestant pulpits are preaching the very things which further Rome's interests, their insistence upon the freedom of fallen man's will to do good must fill the papisters with the light and the counsel of Trent. She anathematized all who affirm the contrary. To what extent the leaven of popery has spread may be seen in evangelical Protestants who oppose the doctrine of lecture are now employing the cell pipe, and the same objections were used by Italian doctors 400 years ago. But to come now to some of the objections, for such a doctrine is utterly unreasonable. When it suits her purpose, Rome makes a big pretense of appealing to human reason, but at other times she demands that her children close their mental eyes and accept blindly whatever their mother, unholy mother, is pleased to palm upon them. Yet Rome is by no means the only offender at this point. Multitudes of those who regard themselves as Protestants are guilty of the same thing. So too, almost the first response of those who make no religious profession, when they have this truth presented to their notices, to exclaim, "Such a concept does not appeal to me at all. If there is a God, and if he has anything at all to do with our present lives, I believe he will give us all an equal chance for balancing the good deeds against our bad and be merciful unto us. To say that he has favorites among his creatures, that he fixed the destiny of everyone before his birth, strikes me as outrageous."
Well, that's what a lot of people think. They think that he fixed people's birth before they were born, where it was outrageous. But it's not outrageous, because that's what Christ did. The children being not yet born, not having done any good or evil, purpose of God according to election might stand. Not of works, but of him that calleth. He said, "Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated." Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one unto honor and one unto dishonor? Anyway. Hope you all have a good day, and thank you, Mark, for reading that for us. God bless.